This feature of the Science News Radio Network is coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And so good to be with you again. Welcome back. The exciting world, the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, and open innovation right here on the Science News Radio Network. Want to remind those of you listening on radio, you can also hear us commercial-free online and webcast at promiseoftomorrow.biz. A very exciting show today for us. We're going to, of course, visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of. And, of course, we're going to visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set in the second half of the program. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. Interesting question we're going to have for the fountain of useless information. Really is. And if you know a little bit about sports, you're going to find it interesting. But even those of us who know nothing about sports, it's a fascinating question. And it has to do, well, anyway, you stick around and listen to it in the second half hour, and you'll see what I'm talking about. So we've got today two exciting guests today. First of all, Susan Lunte is speaking at PittCon, the Pittsburgh conference that's coming up real quick, just a few weeks away. I hope you plan to attend it. It's going to be very, very exciting. PittCon, you know, has grown beyond its roots in analytical chemistry and spectroscopy. The PittCon's it's evolved into a conference, an expo that serves a really diverse constituency: life sciences, pharmaceutical discovery, food safety, environmental and bioterrorism markets. You can register for PittCon at pittcon.org. That's PittCon.org. And just a little bit, Jack Bishop's going to come on, and he's going to talk to Susan Lunte, and she's going to explain what she's going to be doing with her keynote address. Really some fun stuff. And then in the second half hour, we've got a treat for you. You probably remember Desiree Battelle-Anderson with FEMA. Desiree Battelle-Anderson brought innovation to FEMA. FEMA, this is the old FEMA that was so bad in during Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. This is the brilliant FEMA that has done so well with Hurricane Sandy and the aftermath of the tornadoes that went through Moore, Oklahoma, up near Oklahoma City. And Desiree Battelle-Anderson is instrumental in seeing that technology has been brought right down to the street level from FEMA. So all the wonderful things that are going on with FEMA, a lot of it you can lay at the feet of the fine work of Desi Anderson. The neat thing is that she has expanded her operation. She's left being exclusive for FEMA. She's still working with FEMA, and is expanding her operation around the world, as a matter of fact. And she is also, we now have her. She's a correspondent now for the Science News Radio Network, right here in this program. So she's going to give us kind of a preview in the second half hour of some of the things that she's going to be about. Right now, I want to turn it over to my distinguished colleague, Jack Bishop.
Well, once again, we're talking about what's coming up at PittCon. Susan Lunte is the R.N. Adams Professor of Chemistry and Pharmaceutical Chemistry at the R.N. Adams Institute for Bioanalytical Chemistry at the University of Kansas at Lawrence. We thank you for being here with us today. You know, PittCon is, I hate to say it, but it's really kind of right around the corner, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's coming up really quick.
Coming up March 2nd through the 6th in Chicago. And I wanted to ask you, I rattled off all of your titles and accolades. Exactly what are you going to be talking about?
Well, I have a couple of talks there. One is on a project we called sort of the Lab on a Sheep.
Oh, I like that title.
Yeah, so we're working on trying to develop sensors that you can use to monitor brain chemistry and behavior simultaneously. And they're chip-based, so they're a little bit bigger than we'd like. So we're using a larger model organism, sheep, as opposed to like a rat or something like that.
Mm-hmm,
so, yeah, we have a talk on that in a session entitled "There Are Many Ways to Skin a Cat" or something like that.
Well, seeing as how I have cats, I know how much they are difficult when it comes to skinning. You know, I was watching something on television, just on regular old TV, the other day, about a new series that's starting where someone is embedded with a chip in their brain and they have access to the internet and NSA files and all of this, and I didn't really realize when you and I were going to be talking a few days later how unfuturistic what was on TV really was. You know, this seems like a really cutting-edge kind of endeavor that you're going to be talking about and that you're currently involved in the research in. What are the implications for us about all of this?
Well, what we hope to be able to do is, there's two ways that we devise. One is, as I said, monitoring behavior and neurochemistry so we can understand better what neurotransmitters are released for feeding and for fighting and for aggression or depression. We can also look at the effects of drugs on those neurotransmitter levels in a social setting. You can have more than one sheep and be able to monitor multiple the behavior between sheep, and then look at the neurotransmitters and see how they're changing between due to social interactions and things like that. So it'd give us a better understanding of sort of how the mind works in a social context. But we're also hoping to use the same device to monitor some neurotransmitters for TBI patients, possibly in the ICU unit. So we could use the same methodology. When someone experiences a traumatic brain injury, they usually remove the skull in order to relieve the pressure on the brain, and they actually insert probes already in the brain to monitor pressure and oxygen. So we can insert this third probe in the brain and then hopefully monitor different neurotransmitters that might cause brain injury or memory loss or something like that.
So for those of us who don't know, TBI, you said that just a moment ago. What does that stand for?
It's a traumatic brain injury.
Okay.
People in the military, especially if there's a lot of cases of traumatic brain injury. And then among adolescent boys, there's a high precedence for traumatic brain injury just due to high-risk accidents, you know, with motorcycles or falling and things like that.
You're talking about my son. Be careful. Now...
We all know somebody that's at that. Yeah.
Well, I've got a boy who has never passed up a chance to have a motorcycle accident when he could have one.
Oh, no, that's horrible. Now, he wears a helmet, I hope.
Well, he does wear a helmet now, but, you know, he learned the hard way. Now,
yeah.
I am wondering, as we talk about this area of endeavor, the outcomes that you're looking for could be so far-reaching for people who are stroke victims or, like you said, people who have traumatic brain injuries.
Mm-hmm.
Does it have any implications as far as getting into that area that is mostly a mystery to me of brain chemistry?
Yeah, it does. I mean, we can now monitor brain chemistry pretty easily in rats, we can do it in sheep, no problem. The problem with human brain chemistry is to monitor the actual brain chemistry, you have to you can only do it on patients that would already have a sensor or a probe implanted. So, like traumatic brain injury patients would be probably the most amenable to this. Maybe some epileptics patients, because they will have electrodes sometimes implanted in their brains, but basically to actually monitor like normal human brain chemistry would be difficult because no one would really want to do brain surgery just to see what's going on in their brain, I don't think.
I understand. So we're a long way from the Captain Picard.
It's not quite there yet.
We're going to pass the scan over you and see what your brain chemistry is.
This is still somewhat invasive, so it would really just be used on patients in the ICU or laboratory animals at this point.
We're talking with Susan Lunte. She is the R.N. Adams Professor of Chemistry and Pharmaceutical Chemistry at the Ralph N. Adams Institute for Bioanalytical Chemistry at the University of Kansas. That's in Lawrence. I always like to add that. And she's going to be one of the speakers at PITCOM, the Pittsburgh Conference of Analytical Chemistry and Applied. And Susan, help me with this because I always have trouble with it. Spectroscopy. Did I say it right that time?
Yeah, I believe so.
Close enough, huh? Now, I want to remind everybody, that's coming up March 2nd through 6th, and it's going to happen at the McCormick Place Center in Chicago. Registration, by the way, is open now at pitcon.org. And if you register before February 10th, you get a $150 discount. Now, I want to point out, although we're recording this program at this time, we're going to be playing the program during February, which is Women in Science Month. Now, I'm going to ask you then, you sound like a perfectly normal young lady. Why did you get into science?
Oh, I don't know. I always liked science. When I was a kid, I just enjoyed the classes that we had in elementary school and junior high, and my dad enrolled me in some. I grew up in Detroit, so there's a Cranbrook Institute, so he enrolled me in some rock hunting class or something there, and I guess I just always found it pretty fascinating. So, and then I've just been lucky to have a lot of good teachers and good mentors along the way that have kept on encouraging me to go that direction.
Well, good for you. Now, I'm going to ask a question that may not really require a complex answer, so we'll kind of play with it a little bit. There was a time when we did not see a lot of women going into the scientific endeavors.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a time where we began to see that turn around.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm beginning to wonder, in talking to some of the young women that I talk to, including those in my family, that once again we're slipping back behind encouraging young girls and women to pursue a career in science. Am I right or am I wrong about that?
Yeah, I don't know. The generation just before me, there really were not very many women in science, and there was really very, very few women faculty. And then in my generation, when I went to grad school, there were, I think, 60 incoming grad students at Purdue, and I think there were 10 women maybe in that whole class. But now, at least at KU, I would say our graduate class is probably half women.
Really?
Yeah. Now, I don't know whether, I think in general, women tend to be in the sciences where they can see how it can be applied more readily. So I think you see a lot more women in, say, biology and chemistry. There's not as many women, at least not here, in engineering and physics. But I don't know. I definitely think that the U.S. needs to get better at science education for both men and women.
Well, how do we fare in that area compared to the rest of the world?
I think we need to better prepare the students maybe in terms of what science is really about. Maybe get them. I know there's a lot of people that are trying to do this, especially through the National Science Foundation and different different national and regional outreaches, but I think, you know, getting people to realize that science is not just memorizing a million facts so that they can pass a test so that the school looks good, but actually show them that science is really an exploratory adventure, and you make a hypothesis and then you go on, and it can be really frustrating at times, but, you know, when you actually get something to work or something comes, because you were frustrated for so long, it's really exciting, you know, and you get you get really excited about that, and it really makes it all worthwhile. I think, I don't know how other countries, usually we see a lot of really good students from other countries here in our graduate programs, but of course a lot of them are the best of the best of their countries, so it's hard for me to say as a whole, you know, what the differences are. But I think another thing that I've noticed is, being able to, that people should emphasize not only the scientific exploration, the scientific method, you know, get them more involved in relevant scientific concepts, so that even if they don't go into science, just so they understand the issues, because there's a lot of issues that the legislature faces every day that have scientific basis, and if people don't understand or just are really naive about different issues, then you know, the electorate is just, we could just go down some really bad paths. But I think also being able to write like a paper or keep a good lab notebook, or I think that's a skill that needs to be reemphasized maybe at the high school and college level.
Do you think we run off some of our best minds as far as potential science students just by the way we sort of dummy down some of the things we see kids doing in junior high school and high school and so-called science classes?
Yeah, I do. I mean, my kids, I have a 21-year-old and a 24-year-old, and they went through, I think part of the problem is it's hard to keep a good science teacher at a school, especially a high school, because, because they probably have a BS in some sort of scientific discipline, they can make a lot more money with a lot less hassle out. So at least what I've seen is that a lot of high school science teachers don't last that long. They'll teach for 2 or 3 years, and then they'll go into something that they can make more money. So I think we really need to value these science teachers and, not just assume that everybody's going to be incredibly altruistic and not, you know, and be poor for their whole life because they want to push science, but actually, you know, reward and good science teachers, encourage people to teach chemistry, physics, and math in the high schools, and try and, you know, increase the number of good teachers that are there, because I think it's really difficult for, we have a program here in Kansas called You Can Teach, where we're trying to actually teach, have people at KU get both a degree in a science in chemistry or physics or biology, and then they also take education classes, and they go and teach somewhere in Kansas, and that's really because there aren't enough science teachers to go around. So I think that's one of the big problems. If you have people that are teaching science that aren't entirely qualified to do it, it gets dumbed down, and then there's no enthusiasm, and so the students just sort of say, oh, well, this isn't really what I'm interested in.
Now, you're doing something with the Cobre Center...
Molecular Analysis of Disease Pathways.
Yeah. Now, is that anything different than what we talked about at the beginning of our interview?
Yeah, it is. It's a... So Kansas is a COBRA state, which means that, you know, we're below a certain amount of NIH funding compared to the national. So we have this opportunity to get these Centers for Biomedical Research Excellence. And so myself and my two co-PIs, Blake Peterson and Eric Lundquist, put together a COBRA proposal. Basically, what the COBRA does is it encourages... tries to help young faculty, people at the assistant professor level or associate professor level, become competitive for NIH funding. So in the COBRA, we have three, it's really focused on sort of chemistry, biology, of molecular analysis of disease pathways. So we have a microfluidics core where we can use developed lab-on-a-chip devices to do imaging of model organisms or develop sensors. We have a next-gen sequencer, so we can do genomic analysis of model organisms and blood samples or whatever. And then we also have a molecular probes core where Blake Peterson can develop custom-made fluorescence imaging probes for different analytes. And then we have four young investigators that are funded by the COBRA. They're in engineering, chemistry, and molecular biosciences, and they're working on anything from genetic basis of disease to looking at lung surfactants and the effect of different combinations of lung surfactants on the ability, for prenatal and disease. And then we have four other additional sort of pilot projects where we've also fund some other young investigators, and they're working in the areas of nanotechnology, genetics, and then one guy's got an animal model for Tourette syndrome that he's doing. So it's really sort of a way to increase the infrastructure at the University of Kansas so people can do research, and also to help these young investigators become competitive so then KU becomes more competitive for NIH and other federal funding.
Yeah, and I forget that college today is not only competitive for the students and the teachers, but for the institutions even more so than when I was in school more years ago than I care to admit to. Now, we have this illusion, I believe, and tell me if I'm wrong, that there's all this federal funding out there. And while there is, you've got to be doing some pretty slick stuff to get it. Am I right?
Yeah, and it's getting more and more. I mean, it's really become much more competitive. I mean, it used to be, you know, you had about a 1 in 5 chance. Or 20%. If you got a score of 20% or better on your grant, you were pretty good shape. But now it's like 1 in 10, 1 in 5.
Wow, that's quite a drop.
Yeah, it's really gotten much tighter. And so a lot of people that have been, I'm on a study section, and you see this, a lot of people that have been funded for many years, they're doing excellent work. Either have to delay and submit it a couple times, and then they might get it, or sometimes, you know, it just doesn't make it. So I think that's going to really dampen research. We're going to see the effect definitely over the next 5 years if it doesn't change, because a lot of really good research groups are going to start sort of slowing down, and some are going to be shut down, I think. So.
Now, what you just said leads me to this question. How do you handle the pressure of that?
I don't know. I guess it's just part of the job, so you just keep trying.
As my grandma used to say, pull up your big girl panties and get on with it.
Yeah, that's pretty much all you can do. I mean, you can't, you can start looking at some alternative ways to, you know, get research done and move around different, you know, to different projects, things. But, you just have to, I mean, there's been other periods. I think in the 80s we had a big slump in NIH funding, and it was sort of the same deal. You know, a lot of groups, some people just gave up. So hopefully it'll turn around and, because, I mean, when it gets to a point where there's a lot of good proposals and you know that, you know, they're funding the best science, but there's a lot of same best science that's not getting funded. That's bad, I think.
Recently talked to someone in a related field to yours, mm-hmm. who said if we had have continued spending, or rather funding, scientific endeavors at the rate that we funded them in the late 60s, early 70s, Japan would just be a quaint place to visit and take pictures.
Yeah, well, actually, it's not Japan anymore. It's China.
Yeah, China. I should have said
and Australia and Brazil. There's a lot of places that are, you know, really encouraging. I mean, they're in their 60s and 70s right now. I mean, they're putting a lot of money into funding research and building up their institutions and yeah, if we don't turn around, we could be left behind. That's at least what I'm seeing.
We're going to wrap up right now, but I want to ask you this. If people listening who are your peers or people, young people in science studies in college wanted to get in touch with you to find out a little bit more about what you're doing and mm-hmm. who can't attend PidCom, is there a good email address that you could give them?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. It's just slunty@ku.edu.
And let's spell Lunty for those that are spelling impaired like I am.
Okay.
Lunte.
Mm-hmm.
Susan, it has been a real pleasure to talk to somebody who is doing the kind of cutting edge things that you're doing, and we hope to get you back on the program soon.
Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Sam Rayburn. You know, there's no limit to the amount of good you can accomplish if you're willing to let somebody else take the credit.